First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
A local church faces backlash after issuing a controversial statement. No more hate speech can go on buildings without their owner's permission. And back to the drawing board for a proposed development on the South Bank. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We are live with you from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the biggest stories of the week with our Friday roundtable, and you can join us. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, we drop in on popular PBS host Samantha Brown. She visits St. Augustine for her hit show, Places to Love. That's later on. But first, it's Friday, and here to round up all the week's top stories, we welcome Nikesha Williams of Jacksonville Today. Hey, Nikesha. Actually, we'll have Nikesha in a minute. Here in studio, Dan Scanlon of our own WJCT News.
Good morning.
Regular contributor Charles Griggs.
Good morning, Melissa.
And former City Council President, regular contributor Jack Webb.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Good to have all of you and everybody listening. You can join us too. The number 549-2937. Let's begin with our top story. Did you hear about this? The First Baptist Church of Jacksonville is now requiring all its parishioners to sign a statement confirming that they believe people are either male or female, and that this creation is a fixed matter of human biology. The statement says marriage should only be between one man and woman and is the only context for sexual desire and expression. Members have until March 19th to sign the document to avoid any interruption of their membership. Now, the First Baptist Church has a long history of opposing LGBTQ rights. They opposed the city's human rights ordinance update, for example, which prevented businesses from discriminating against LGBTQ people in the context of employment, public accommodation, and housing. Senior Pastor Heath Lambert posted a video message on the First Baptist Church of Jack's website saying everyone that goes to the church must sign the document. He says the church is attempting to share God's love with what he called a deeply confused culture. So give us a call as we discuss this. It's 549-2937. Pastor Lambert saying many members in his congregation are struggling, as he puts it, with gender and sexuality issues. 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax or Facebook too, guys. All right, Dan Scanlon, you've been covering the First Baptist Church in Jacksonville for decades now. What are your thoughts about this new statement?
Well, you know, this used to be the church. It covered a 10-square-block area. It had 13,000 people at its Sunday events. Its pastors, like in the 80s and 90s, were always sought out for conferences with political officials. Political officials were there at the churches, and obviously they still have some strength. But in a story that I just picked up yesterday on the Baptist News Global website, they were down to 3,000 congregants as of pre-COVID. And they did try to sell 9 of their 10 buildings, apparently, and then stopped that because of COVID. So they're down in numbers, as are almost every church out there. But they're still strong, and they still obviously fought against the human rights ordinance, sending busloads of people, in fact. If you take a look at their parent organization, Southern Baptist Convention, there is a whole page full of resolutions talking about LGBT and sexual issues that they believe in. So it's no surprise that this being once the third largest congregation in the country for them would indeed hew the line on this. The question is, how many have left? How many are griping about it? That's how we found out about it, was people were griping about this.
Griping about the statement,
about
being
the
asked
fact
to
that
sign
they,
this statement?
It's had signed the statement, which basically nicely says that if you choose not to sign it, we give you blessings and please leave. If you wish to sign up again with our church, you will sit down with a pastor and you will discuss this issue with us. I guess you have to be vetted before you come back in, but you have to sign saying that you are male or female and that you believe in a male and female marriage, and that is the only way to go.
Which obviously excludes LGBT LGBTQ people and non-binary or transgender people. Charles Griggs, the pastor, saying that the statement, and I'm quoting, is to rule out sexual sins, pornography, polygamy, fornication, adultery, and homosexuality. He's equating sex outside of marriage with pornography and calls homosexuality a sin as well.
Yeah, that is fascinating because, you know, we're all fractured vessels, and it seems like the church would be a place for healing and, you know, and to bring people together. You know, since the beginning of written history, as far back as we can remember or think, religion has been proven to be more divisive than politics. And most religions, you know, they profess to be rooted in love. And let's be clear, any religion that practices exclusionary principles cannot be rooted in love. So that is, you know, what the circumstances are here. It sounds like many people are going to be leaving to, you know, to seek a home, a church home, or that they can, you know, you can count on, you know, some place where they feel like is more welcoming to them. And I'll say this too, Melissa, you know, many people who know me know that my grandmother was a pastor, and we used to have church in our house. And I can recall nothing but inclusiveness for all people, regardless of what they brought to the sanctuary, regardless of what they brought to our home. And, you know, I can't imagine walking into a building considered to be a sanctuary of love and being told that you're not welcome.
Jack Webb, you know, you're a Catholic. Just the other day, Pope Francis made comments about the LGBTQ community, saying homosexuality is not a crime, calling for an end to anti-gay laws. Not just the First Baptist Church, but all faith denominations that hold more conservative views about human sexuality are struggling to grow their membership, as increasingly the culture has departed from those views. People are broadly accepting of sex outside of marriage, getting married more than once, accepting of the gay community, et cetera. And so what do you think about all of this as a Catholic?
It's very interesting. I think that I listened to the Pope's comments, and I was listening to NPR, Father James Martin, who is the theologian writer, who also happens, like the Pope, to be a Jesuit, very informative. And but it's what he was saying, and talking about what Pope Francis had done was to change the dialogue, not necessarily change the teaching, but, you know, change the dialogue. And that's what's unfortunate. You're free to believe whatever you want, and you're free to have, I guess, conditions upon membership in your church. I mean, that's your choice. But as Charles was saying, it's placing. It's interesting to me, and I read the website. It says, and his comments, it's right that every member agree to such a statement before they join us to receive our care. I mean, I think it's the antithesis of what Charles was stating, you know, of faith and Christian charity, that you're placing conditions on care and compassion. That is not consistent with the gospel message.
Right.
And that's and I think that's what the Pope is trying to say, is that we can believe what we believe, but it doesn't change the doesn't eliminate the human dignity of every living person. And that's what we need to be. We need to address and dialogue over and understand each other.
Nikisha Williams, what are your thoughts?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I think my first thought is that I'm glad I don't go to First Baptist Church. Secondly, how dare you, as the Bible says, take the plank out of your own eye before you judge somebody for their speck. We all have sin. So if we're going to talk about sin, it's lying, it's stealing, it's murder, it's not loving your neighbor, it's trying to have conditions on care and compassion, as Jack just said. We all fall short of the perfection of Christ, which is what they're supposed to be teaching and preaching. The church is a hospital for healing. So to tell someone that they cannot step foot in your church or and claim membership to your community is hypocritical and antithetical to the Bible that you profess to teach to those you want to help. That is absolutely ridiculous. Furthermore, there have been gay people, lesbians, non-binary, and transgender since the beginning of time. We all fall short of God's love. But that doesn't mean that God isn't love and he doesn't still love us and that he didn't all create us, no matter how we identify, what sexuality we choose and what parts that we have. No matter what, God is love and he loves us and he created us in his image. So we need to begin to expand the dogma that has been relied on for 2,000 years to include people who are demanding that they be respected and that they be seen and that they be treated with dignity. And for a church pastor to say that their members have to reject the inclusiveness and the equity of others who need help and who need love and who need care and who need compassion is antithetical to the message they're supposed to be preaching. How dare you?
And I hear the passion in your voice, Nikisha. Dan Scanlon, she touches on a larger issue, which is that whether it's this story involving the local First Baptist Church or any number of other controversies going on right now, we're seeing a widespread backlash to communities that had been extremely marginalized for a long time, claiming their space in society and saying, you know, we want to be treated with respect, dignity, and equality, particularly the transgender community in recent years, but the LGBT community as well.
All I can say is it's obvious this church is trying to hew back to what their version of the Bible is, despite the fact that on Channel 4 this week they did to speak to another pastor who said your biblical times, as she just mentioned, were full of all probably kinds of families, multiple wives, multiple nationalities. A church should accept all. It's the open door policy, and the church I go to, anybody is there. Everybody is there. Our pastor is black. We have Chinese, Vietnamese, Cuban priests in our church. It is a whole melting pot of everybody.
And, what church is that?
It's Christ the King Catholic Church in Arlington. And in fact, the pastor, Father Bodie, Monsignor Bodie, is very involved in some anti-crime issues in the city. So it's really refreshing to have him as our pastor, but that's personal. The bottom line is you have to sign up and be vetted to be a member, I believe, of First Baptist. And that sounds a little opposite of what a church should be, which is, come on, y'all, hang out with us. Let's talk. Let's forget about the garbage outside and let's just focus on the message in the big book, which is, as Keisha said, love everybody.
All right, let's go to your calls. 549-2937. Sue in Mandarin. Go ahead, Sue.
I just wanted to say, again, that's not the message of the original Baptist faith and church from way back when. I grew up in the Baptist church many, many years ago, and they talked about love. They sent out missionaries. You can't be pushing the message of love if you're pushing exclusivity and a membership. I would be paying dues and going to the church and subscribing to that. That's not working.
Do you still go to church, Sue?
Not the Baptist church.
All right, Sue, thanks. 549-2937. Charles in Springfield. Hello, Charles.
Hey, good morning. I just wanted to kind of get a little bit of my experience growing up gay. You know, I was born and raised into a Catholic church, but I knew from an early age, that I was different, that I was gay. I didn't kind of really know, those words until, I got into junior high and high school. But, when I was 15 years old, I was in my room praying to God to make me normal because society, was telling me who I should be and who I shouldn't be. But I was ready to end it. And so I had, put a shotgun in my mouth, ready to pull the trigger. And because I didn't feel like I had anyone to turn to. And now here we have, a church, a local church, prominent local church, just further cutting off the ties where people can feel comfortable of to be who they are. And I can only imagine what this is going to do, to our youth. And I really just hope that the membership pushes back. This is not the message of God. This is not the message, that we all should be, pushing forward. And that's, to this day, I'm still on my own journey to find, you know, my faith again, because again, I was told, you know, hate the sin, but love the sinner. And yet in all of that, I'm still the sinner. And, it's disgusting. It really is.
Well, Charles, so, I'm so sorry you had that experience, truly. And I'm so glad you're still with us. And I really appreciate you calling in. And so thank you. And, you know, Charles Griggs, these kinds of policies do real psychological harm to young people who want to have a connection to a faith community.
Yeah, it is. It's still sort of mind-boggling to understand why an institution would want to, you know, sort of eradicate itself from society in this manner. You know, the first thought I get is that perhaps this is, you know, this is done on purpose in order to move them away from from what the societal norms are, and to find a place where our community doesn't want to be. You know, this is, you know, Jacksonville is a place that's changing in a lot of ways. We like to believe that we're being a little bit more progressive than we were, you know, during Jim Crow time. And one of the first things that I thought about under this, when this story broke, was, you know, how there used to be images of people in Ku Klux Klan outfits sitting in church sanctuary, right? You know, what is this? You know, why are we being so exclusionary when it comes to the one place that's supposed to provide, you know, love and passion for, you know, people within the community? And if folks can't walk through the door and feel like they have, there's a presence there where they're welcome, you know, at the church, then I don't know where else you can go.
Mike tweets the show, churches should be about love, community, and justice. You should check out the Buckman Bridge Unitarian Universalist Church, or the Unitarian Universalist Church of Jax, he says. On Facebook, lots of commentary. Here's one from George. Christ said, love thy neighbor. The First Baptist Church, get out of my house. Martin on Facebook, the church may find many members choosing to vote with their feet, leaving to find a more kind place to pray, he says. Barry in Orange Park. Go ahead, Barry.
Good morning. I have been listening in on the conversation, and while I do not necessarily agree with First Baptist Church, the church has always been a place where it has been exclusive and inclusive at the same time. And in its duality has some particular parameters. So each church probably has a right to exercise, or should I say, follow that discipline. The second thing that I want to mention is that love is not the antithesis of following your dogma. All churches have covenants that one must sign in order to be a part of that particular faith community. And if you are not in agreement with those dogmas, most churches do not allow you to become a part of it. For instance, if you join a Christian church and you say, I don't believe in the virgin birth or that Jesus is Savior, many of the churches will not allow you to be a part of it. So what I would just say is that it's too much of a crisis. I believe in social justice over that particular faith community following its dogma, but they all do it in Jacksonville, Florida. That's my comment.
All right. Thank you, Barry. Thank you for that. Jack?
Interesting. You know, my daughter, on a personal level, my daughter was home last week, and she's finishing up a master's degree in Georgia, and she works with marginalized communities. And she was talking about the adverse impact, the negative impact that these exclusionary dialogue has on mental health and suicide, that lack of acceptance. And Charles from Springfield just reflected that. I have a very, very close family member who is gay, and struggled for a long, long time with it, much like Charles did as well. And ultimately developed a severe drinking problem as a result of it, and wound up getting himself into all sorts of trouble. And I remember having a conversation with him. I said, listen, whatever you are is who you are. We still love you. But if, you know, if you have to understand who you are and come to terms with it and be who God made you, accept it and embrace your life. It's better to be who you are than to try and be something you're not and destroy yourself in that effort.
Lots of comments rolling into the show. Here's an email from Judy. Florida's new laws like the Don't Say Gay law and Stop Woke policies are emboldening homophobia and hate in our community. Jim emails the show, for anyone looking for a church that embraces everyone, please visit Riverside Church at Park and King. All are welcome. People are advertising their churches now. Hey, come see us.
And Melissa, Melissa, you know, I would have to, you know, kind of go back to the previous caller and say that, you know, I'm no theologian. I am. But the covenants that most churches have are really specifically tied back to the love of Christ, right? And so everything from what I was taught is rooted in love. I mean, you know, when we used to get do our Bible verse, if we didn't have one for the day, you'd just say, Jesus is love, you know, and that was it. That was the bottom line, how we're supposed to operate. That was our guiding principle for Christian values.
And not to leave Nikisha out. Nikisha, your turn to chat. Go, please.
I think the problem is that our religiosity is getting in the way of our spirituality. Mm. And that's the problem, not just with the policy that First Baptist is implementing by having their members sign this paper, but that's a problem that's facing all of Christianity and has faced religions across the world. If you look at the difference in Islam between what is jihad and what is, you know, sound doctrine in Islam and Muslim culture and how it's been perverted. The same thing is happening in Christianity, and it happens in lots of other religions. We are letting religiosity and texts that are being interpreted and were written by man and supposed to be the infallible word of God determine how we are supposed to relate to one another, when at the end of the day, it's love God and love your neighbor as yourself. Everything else is for God to settle. So do those two things. Worry about making sure that your members, the community that you serve, the people who need help, who need care, who need compassion, who need someone to listen to their struggle so that they don't end up with a gun in their mouth, and know that it's okay if you can't pray the gay away, because God loves you as you are. And so don't let religiosity get in the way of leading people to a life that's filled with the love of God. And I think that's the problem that people fail to see and don't want to recognize, as they double down and conflate religion with politics in the name of taking a stand on these cultural issues that have no business being in the church.
Thanks for that. And if you're just tuning in, it's 549-2937. As we continue to talk about this, let's talk about another big story from the week. A new ordinance in town will make it illegal to project unauthorized signs or messages onto buildings without the building owner's permission. This is in response to a series of racist and anti-Semitic displays that have been projected onto buildings around town in recent months. The city council approved this legislation 18-1 on Tuesday night. But there was first, Dan Scanlon.
Wednesday morning.
It went till after midnight.
Trust me.
Yes. Unfortunately, you were there till Wednesday morning.
Well, I was monitoring it from home.
Okay. But you were awake.
But I was awake till 12:30 a.m.
And there were two identical bills on this matter, which sort of relates to another ongoing story in the city. The mayoral election in March.
It is hard to believe that 1 week ago we were reporting on the fact that Leanna Cumber, candidate for mayor, and Mr. Freeman, head of the city council, had both proposed identical bills and were talking about them at news conferences. Ms. Cumber had hers right in front of the CSX building with the CSX spokesperson there. And yet it appeared initially that Leanna's bill was first in the queue. Late into the agenda.
And she, of course, is a candidate for mayor. We've invited her onto this program.
And unfortunately, somehow Mr. Freeman's bill, through some procedural matter, or organization got into the queue first and was the one that was voted on, and he ended up with the 18-1 approval. He initially had 13, then 14 council members co-sponsoring it, and much of the debate early into Wednesday morning at the council was how that happened and how these two bills were in the order they were in, with Mr. Freeman questioning an assistant general counsel for yes-no answers as to how this thing got in. The bottom line is, this is projection on a building. This is molecular level. This is transient. This is not physical graffiti. And the city council, as my story on WJCT News pointed out, with some attorneys speaking about it, appears to be neutral in content. It does not state you can't have this or that message. It only says you cannot project anything onto public or private without the owner's consent, which one of my legal experts said should help it avoid a First Amendment challenge. Another said, I don't know. Now we've got a Delray Beach lawmaker from Florida proposing this on the state level, but I heard this morning on NPR that they're also including some physical graffiti into the bill, which to my knowledge and those attorneys I spoke with could bring a state law up for potential First Amendment. So it was a very interesting night. There were some big rezonings that took a lot of time and a lot of people yelling at the city council. But in this case, they were sort of quietly yelling at
each
other.
Jack is sitting over here laughing that he no longer has to endure the yelling. He seems very at peace with that.
Well, it was a very interesting dynamic during the discussion, but Jack and I were discussing it, so maybe we should toss it to Jack.
First Jack, then Charles.
First of all, I'm shocked and I'm disgusted that politics would involve...
That there's gambling going on here in Casablanca. Oh, my God.
Thank you, Rick.
But that said, I think kudos to the city council, whoever gets the credit for it, for getting this thing through. I looked at the bill. It is content neutral. I think it will withstand First Amendment scrutiny. And, I was looking, and it's a second degree misdemeanor, I believe, is what it does, right? Okay, so that begs the question, so it's enforced by whom? Building codes, JSO, I don't know. We'll dig into that as we move on. If there's a state companion state statute, that's even better. But I think the bigger question, though, is what private right of action do property owners have? And before I came on the show, I did some research on it. And it seems to me that there are some gaps in the law with regards to the common law. But I pulled up a 2020 Harvard Law Review article, and there are some theories out there that this appropriation of the building for a use is a trespass and a nuisance. So subject to dignity, harm, things of that nature, and damages in that regard as well. So if there was a codification on the state level, I think that's what they should do, is provide for a private right of action and award attorney's fees and damages as a result of this.
The same day that this happened at the CSX building, an AT&T building in West Palm Beach also had a Nazi symbol projected on it. Mm-hmm. So here are two major corporations that could in fact claim that their image, their trademark has been sullied.
They've been damaged.
Yeah. So
Charles Griggs.
Yeah. Wasn't it the late NFL coach Dennis Green who said they are who we thought they were? I mean, even when it's in a situation where we felt like everybody should be in agreement, they find a way to be divided.
The city council, you mean?
Yeah. And this is, par for the course for the way the council operates when it comes to policy around anything that's supposed to be unifying. Somebody's got to get the credit. Even to the point where the amendment came where they wanted to have the names in alphabetical order, so it didn't seem like anybody was getting any particular credit. I mean, in what world? So as far as the bill is concerned, the drama around how it was implemented is more sexy than the bill itself. The action they took, and of course we had those arguing, there's a couple of council members arguing that, why didn't you act this,
do this sooner?
Sooner when it came to Confederate monuments. And couldn't this be an opportunity for you to, address two issues at once? And, many people feel like this is something that the council is good for, putting issues that related to the African-American community on the back burner. We'll see. We'll wait. We're going to get it done later, and then it never happens. And so we'll wait and see what happens during Black History Month around
which
the,
is around the
some
corner.
Of the speakers, in fact, including Ben Frazier, even had the same point. They said, we've been fighting about Confederate monuments and take them down for years, and here you immediately react to some Nazi projections and anti-Semitism.
Right. Here's an email. The council's move only addresses one form of hate displays. The real solution is to remove what draws the hatred to Jacksonville, which is the continued presence of Confederate monuments here. Even the former capital of the Confederacy, Richmond, Virginia, has removed their Confederate monuments. We need to do the same. It is the only way we can end these hateful displays, says one listener. And let's go to Justin in Springfield. Hi, Justin.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call. You know, between these recent anti-Semitic projections and the Confederate banner planes that we see downtown, I know everybody's getting tired of this. I applaud the city council for passing this ordinance. But my question is, how are they actually going to enforce this? You know, I looked online. You can buy these projector kits for under $500, hook them up to your car, and throw them out on a building. My concern is that, are they going to go further into this? There's been some accusations online about the groups responsible for it. But otherwise, it's all after the fact. And I find it almost impossible to enforce this unless they investigate the groups responsible further. Thanks, and I'll listen to your response.
I think they thought about that.
Nikisha Williams, it's my understanding there is a little bit of teeth to this new ordinance. But go ahead, Nikisha.
It baffles me how quickly the council can move on the projection of hate speech, even though it's written more broadly than that, to make sure that it's banned in the city of Jacksonville so that it seems that they're taking a stand on hate and anti-Semitism. But as Ben Frazier and others have noted, they won't do the same on Confederate monuments. They didn't have to study projection of hate speech on buildings. They didn't have to call in folks from another state to see how they've been handling the projection of hate speech on other buildings. They didn't have to have any community conversations. They had to do none of these intermediate steps that they've said they had to do with the Confederate monuments issue to outright ban the projection of images and messages on buildings. But yet for something as equally as hateful, if not more, they have all of these steps in between from what they can do is right, from keeping them from what they can do is right, when they have the money to do it. And there have been myriad plans of what to do with the monuments once they're taken down and removed from public view. So it just goes to show that you value the livelihood and the dignity and the worth and the contributions of one community over another. And that is because, and I hate to say it, but it is because that community can be more closely aligned with whiteness than Black people can. So our oppression and the things that make us feel that we are unwanted and don't belong and not included don't matter to the council. So I agree with Councilwoman Brenda Priestley Jackson in abstaining her vote, because it's a slap in the face to 40% of the population in the city of Jacksonville that you can take a stand on hate speech in one area, but you can't take a stand on hate speech in another.
Thanks for that, Dan Scanlon. And as yet, this council has shown no real inclination to move this forward, although the council president, Terrence Freeman, who is himself African-American, has gone on the record and said they will deal with it this year.
During public comment on Tuesday night, which was hours before this vote, there were a number of speakers who were from the Take 'em Down and Anti-Confederate Monument who basically threw in the same comment that you can't seem to get anything done on the Confederate monuments, and they're hateful and they really are bad for the image, but yet you do this. Now, to bring to Jack's point, how are you going to catch these people? In order to cite anybody in any crime, you have to actually have a witness or see it happen. Mm-hmm. These projectors, the projector on CSX that was done in a very dark part of Jacksonville at night during a football game, by the time anybody got there, they would have been gone, especially if they had it mounted on a truck. The one that was done at the side of the stadium earlier in October, hundreds of people leaving the stadium must have seen that projector, but they probably didn't look up or care much. And did a cop see it? Who knows? That's going to be the issue. Can you catch them, and then can you get the owner to say, I didn't give permission?
That's right.
It's a two pointed sword on that one.
All right, folks. We want to talk about another couple of stories before we say goodbye. I want to talk about a development story here for a minute. The city's Downtown Investment Authority has canceled a deal with the Related Group. Now, what they had planned to do was build an apartment complex on the South Bank at the site of the former River City Brewing Company. Remember that restaurant that got torn down? One of the few restaurants on the water that you could go and eat at? Well, it was torn down for apartments. But now, the Miami-based developer says high interest rates and construction costs mean the project is not going forward. This has caused a collective groan across the city, Charles Griggs, because once again, we see something torn down to make way for new development, and it falls apart. And it's not nearly as critical an issue as the other things we've been talking about. But I think that there's a lot of frustration many people hold that in this city surrounded by water, there are so few waterfront locations. And this was one that people liked, and it got torn down for nothing.
Right. So it appears that the DIA is saying, don't panic. Just hitting the pause button right now.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things that makes people nervous is that Lori Boyer said, who has the DIA, said, we could end up with a much better project. That sounds very ambiguous to a lot of people. Folks really want to know what's going to happen in this spot now that it's been cleared. And we've heard a lot about what the potential is. And then there's also those considerations that we know that people have for what's going to happen environmentally in that area. You know, is it mm-hmm. an area where we should be building apartment complexes? So, you know, again, one of the things that it's like there's so much ambiguity here. At least there's no money up front that's been spent out of the city's pockets. All of the money, most of the money was supposed to be come back in tax rebates. Mm-hmm. So, no harm, no foul so far, but we'll wait and see.
It's the latest piece of the puzzle, Jack, of the Downtown Investment Authority's larger vision to build up the waterfront mm-hmm. on both sides of the river. So it's sort of been one step forward, maybe one and a half steps back.
I was going to say, hopefully it's two steps forward,
yeah,
one step
back. Yeah, hopefully it's that. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Maybe we should go three steps, one step. But yeah, as Charles said, we're hitting the reset button, hitting the pause button, and that's unfortunate. Now, the timing of it all, I mean, I guess I'll leave that to the DIA and the general counsel's office, whoever negotiates contracts with these developers. But, it begs the question, why'd you tear the building down if you don't have a date certain, you don't have your funding in place, you don't have a date certain for commencement of the project, your demolition schedule should be tied in with moving forward on any particular project. I don't negotiate the contracts. But and I don't know who does them on behalf of the DIA, but these are questions that I would ask. You know, it's interesting because the DIA was created to kind of remove politics from these projects mm-hmm. and kind of focus concerted effort on development in the downtown area, which is great. But perhaps, you know, but it's removed certainly a certain amount of scrutiny by the city council. You know, back in the day when John Crescenbeny would fly spec every aspect of every contract that came before it. I mean, that's good and bad, but any event, hopefully they'll get it going. But well, one other thought, though, it's unfortunate because it does kind of cast a pall on people's perceptions of promises that are made with regards to downtown redevelopment. And that's not a good thing.
Right, right. And, you know, not only that, Nikisha, it's yet another apartment complex that was slated to be built there. And in the last few years, those are being put up literally everywhere you look. The question, though, is how affordable are some of the units for people who have been moving here in droves?
And I think that is something that the Downtown Investment Authority should definitely look at, because as has been buzzing since at least I've lived in Jacksonville, this push to get more people into living downtown, into living in the urban core, and making it walkable and making it excitable and having places where people can go in this, you know, vibrant downtown cultural scene. Part of that needs to address is housing and affordability, which of the apartments that have been going up, a lot of them have been more luxury high rises and lofts and things like that, where 1, 2, and 3 bedrooms, due to inflation and the market, housing is costing for rent, you know, upwards of $1,500. And that's just not affordable to everyone in the city. So it is an opportunity for the DIA to go back to the drawing board, and as ambiguous as it may sound, to come up with something better. But I think what we all don't want to see is like another parking lot or another Lenny's lawn or another another empty space of blight that used to be something that was really enjoyable for the community to go to a restaurant on the riverfront and have a nice night out. And now it's just a fenced in
piece of pavement. I think that's the concern that people have.
Yeah, I had a Facebook post yesterday that said this is one of 20 lawns along the river right now that's undeveloped. That said, my story on JCT did talk about the fact that that whole quadrant of South Bank is being developed. The fountain should be back up and running soon. The Mosh building is going to turn into something when Mosh leaves to go across the river. And Lori seems to think that she will have a new contract with multifamily and
Lori Boyer, CEO of the DIA.
And a mandatory restaurant, because that's part of development plans along the river, again, by springtime. So let's wait and see if that happens. And don't forget that fountain with the new lighting and the new amenities should be up and running by spring to summer. So there will be a reason to hang out in that part of the river, and there'll be some people-friendly stuff.
Before we say goodbye, let me make note of another story that we will discuss in much greater detail today at noon on our statewide show, the Florida Roundup. We've heard a lot from teachers this week around town. This isn't just a local story. It's happening across Florida. A new state law is no longer allowing Florida teachers to keep little libraries in their classrooms. All books have to be reviewed by media specialists or librarians to ensure the books are age appropriate. Teachers have been told to cover up their libraries, either remove the books or put construction paper over the books, or face felony prosecution. And so this is in response, Charles, to a new law that requires all classroom books be vetted. Teachers have responded that their hearts are breaking at the prospect of having to cover up libraries and reduce access to books to kids, particularly kids who might not otherwise have access to books.
Yeah, this policies are troubling because many of these books that are targeted through this process are really considered to be staples in reading for kids and help kids understand the process of reading and learning itself. It is really troubling because if you are an educator, you know how important it is to act the part, to be the part, and to have books in your classroom to show kids how accessible books are and the adventures they can take by reading books. But to have a situation where teachers are afraid to have books in the classroom is really asinine.
We got a comment from the State Department of Education about this, Jack, explaining the new policy. And what they are saying is that they don't want books that are not age appropriate or that in any way, in their words, try to indoctrinate students allowed in class. What teachers are saying is that they should be given the agency to choose books for kids to read, to light them up with the joy of reading.
You know, I don't know what's happened to the constitutional role of local school boards, but this is a further erosion of that by the state. And what's troubling, one person's indoctrination is another person's education, perhaps. I don't know. But again, I looked at the bill, House Bill 1467, and that books need to be pre-approved or vetted by a media specialist trained by the Department of Education. So it begs the question, who's training the trainer?
And a lot of schools have defunded those positions mm-hmm. as well. That's another issue.
Interesting. And it begs the question, I don't say, why is this necessary? I think it's again, it's the culture. It's a further politicization of education and erosion of local home rule and the constitutional authority of locally elected school board members.
You know, Melissa, I got an anonymous email yesterday from a teacher, and those of you who are streaming this can see, she sent a picture of her classroom's empty bookshelf, nothing on it. She also sent a list of Florida's best standardized kindergarten reading list. There's 24 books. None of them are modern. They're all very old. And they were told every book must be removed from the classroom. That is what she's been told. Plus, there was a video training, apparently, that some teachers went through this week, which JCT is looking at more deeply.
Nikisha.
I just find it, as Charles said, asinine that we are taking books from children, especially at the critical ages when they need them most. And I thought it was so funny. My son had a book fair at his school yesterday. And so there was a whole notice sent out. These books have not been vetted by the media specialist. And if you don't want your child to attend, you have to sign this permission slip for them to go because we can't vouch for all the books that are there. And they're just books. Like, what don't you want children to learn? You call it indoctrination that they learn history and truth and fact in an honest way that's appropriate, that's age appropriate for them. That's crazy. Like, even my son said to me, he's like, Mom, I don't like the new rule that says that we can't have books in our class. Because he's the kind of kid that when he finishes work before his other classmates, he goes to get a book because that's what he likes to do. Right. But now that's not available to him. So you're telling kids you want them to learn, and then you're taking away from them a way that makes learning accessible. So what are we doing? I think that's the indoctrination, but now that word has been co-opted, as so many others have, by the political right.
Well, we welcome everyone's thoughts on this from across the spectrum, and we are just about out of time, but we will discuss that further today at noon on the Florida Roundup, along with a potential lawsuit in response to the state rejecting an AP African American Studies course for high school students. That's all coming up at noon. But first, thank you, Dan Scanlon, Charles Griggs, Jack Webb, and Nikisha Williams for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Melissa.
And in a moment, PBS host Samantha Brown stops by St. Augustine for her show, Places to Love. We'll be right back.
This week on Science Friday, join us as we head into the cloud forests of Southwest Colombia to visit a set of trails that are specifically designed to make nature more accessible for blind and low vision visitors.
My idea is all people together getting an experience in the forest.
That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on WJCT News 89.9.
Police in California struggle to find a motive behind last weekend's mass shooting. Its governor has questions.
What the hell is going on? But it was said, and it's said all the time, only in America.
Also, more classified docs turn up, a Republican divide emerges over America's debt, and Meta clears the way for the former president to return to its platforms. The Friday Roundup returns next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. She's the seasoned travel host you've been watching and loving for years. Now, Samantha Brown has set her sights on the nation's oldest city.
I'm in a city where wandering is encouraged and time meant to be savored. A historic powerhouse of a destination where local events not only shaped it, but an entire country. It's a city of firsts. And also, what's next? With a food scene that is immersive and thoroughly enjoyed. And speaking of joy, with protected wetlands, estuaries, and miles of beautiful beaches to explore, there's a lot to sink your teeth into.
How did you find that?
I looked on the ground.
I'm in St. Augustine, Florida.
We spoke with Samantha about her new episode of Places to Love as she visits St. Augustine. Samantha Brown, it's so good to be with you. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's good to be here.
And, you know, I love your show, Places to Love, on PBS. Your presence as a travel host is so beloved, and you've been just about everywhere in the world, from what I can tell. So I was excited to see you're doing an episode in our neck of the woods in St. Augustine. What made you choose St. Augustine?
Do you know I've never done a show in St. Augustine? Isn't that incredible?
Wow.
Yeah, 23 years of doing a travel show, and that was my first time. So it seemed like the obvious thing to do. But I love doing cities that everyone kind of has a gist about it. So everyone knows St. Augustine is, you know, the oldest, you know, city in the United States, and the Spanish colonial history. But there was so much more to discover. And so a lot of it I wanted to do because I wanted to discover that personally myself.
Sure. So it's known, of course, as the nation's oldest city, and it is historically fascinating. What are some of the things that you spotlight in the episode?
Well, we spotlighted the civil rights history of St. Augustine, the St. Augustine civil rights movement that began in the early 60s and led to the Civil Rights Act of 1965. And it's just a part of that history that's never really told. I think people stop with the Spanish, right? And so much happened after. And we got to hear that story from a wonderful photographer, Lenny Foster, who is documenting areas around St. Augustine that were instrumental, you know, whether it was a swim-in or a sit-in or where Martin Luther King stayed one night. And so we learned through him and about Fort Mose, which I believe was founded by enslaved people who made their escape and got to the Castillo and were granted their own citizenship if they fought against the British, right? So they became Spanish citizens and they were free. So it just this history that surrounds the Castillo as well as St. Augustine that I certainly didn't know, and Lenny Foster, who the photographer, didn't know as well. So it's a big discovery, I think.
Sure. And I'm guessing you checked out some other attractions, maybe some of the great restaurants and other fun places to go?
Yeah, well, I mean, this was the big surprise. We featured two big food scenes, which we don't. We stick to like one. And but there was just so much to do there. And we featured a wonderful restaurant called Llama mm-hmm. Restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And the chef, Marcel Vizcarra, is from Peru. He's Peruvian, and he even went to Cordon Bleu in Lima, Peru.
Mm.
And so he has serious chops, and making sure he has serious chops is his mom, who's also in the kitchen cooking. And the cuisine is inventive. It's modern. It reminds him of his home. And it's totally approachable. So I think this is, it's hard to get Peruvian food anywhere. Like I live in New York City and it's hard to get Peruvian food. So it's this jewel that that is in that city. The other wonderful place we did was at the time more of a pop-up. And now they just established a more permanent residence. I think they have a permanent place called Asado Life. And this is Nick Carrera. And he is an Argentinian who grills in the Argentinian way and does his own form of barbecue. Of course, the South has their barbecue, and he brings something new to the mix. So, but the setting is incredible. You know, it's right on the water and open air, and just the beauty of the city comes through. And it's just this festive, really celebratory environment. So two phenomenal food choices just right there.
That's great. Now, Samantha, I have to ask you, how much time do you spend on the road every year? Because you really have logged a lot of miles.
I have. I spend, you know, I would say pre-COVID, we're getting up to it now, about 150 days on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And that's down from about 220 before I had kids. So now that I have a family,
mm-hmm.
I definitely want to spend more time at home with them and or bring them with me. But yeah, so it's around 150 days I'm on the road.
And do you still love travel as much now as when you started with this journey?
I love people. I love connecting with locals and understanding what they do in their everyday lives. I would say certainly the act of traveling has become more uncertain and difficult, and that's just planes, trains, and the infrastructure and employee shortages and pilot shortages. It's all made it very cumbersome and challenging, but it's always worth it. I will say that. It's always worth it.
Samantha Brown, it's a pleasure. I'm so glad we could highlight the St. Augustine episode on Places to Love, airing, of course, on Jax PBS. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
That's Samantha Brown's Places to Love, St. Augustine, airing tomorrow at 11 a.m. on Jax PBS 7.1, Comcast Channels 8 and 440. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Thanks also to David Luckin, Heather Schatz, Brendan Rivers, Isabella Da Silva, Michelle Corum, and all of you. Drop us a line anytime at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And come back to us today at noon for the Florida Roundup, where we round up the biggest stories from all across the state, including major educational news in Florida. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.